Did you know there's an online cannabis company that ships federally legal THC right to your door? And they found a way to combine THC with carefully selected functional ingredients to create gummies, baked goods, and flower for whatever type of buzz you'd want. I'm talking about Mood.com. They have an incredible line of cannabis gummies, and you get 20% off your first order at Mood.com with promo code SPECIALISTS with an S on the end. This isn't some rinky-dink discount of 5 or 10%. This is 20% off your first order. Forget one-size-fits-all supplements that only get you high. Mood's functional gummies are optimized to kick in as little as 15 minutes and take you to the mood you're looking for. My favorite are the Sleepy Time Advanced gummies. That's right, those are for sleepy time. You know when you just can't fall asleep? Take these and they'll put you right in the mood. Beyond gummies, Mood also has a selection of flower, pre-rolls, bakery treats, and beverages. Listen, you can find gummies to just get you high pretty much everywhere these days. But Mood's functional gummies combine premium, federally legal THC with targeted botanicals to help you get into the perfect mood, usually in as little as 15 minutes. And everything ships discreetly right to your door. No dispensary lines, no awkward conversations, just better days and nights delivered to your doorstep. Best of all, not only is every Mood product backed by a 100-day satisfaction guarantee, but as I mentioned, listeners get 20% off their first order with promo code SPECIALISTS with an S on the end. So head to Mood.com, find the functional gummy that matches exactly what you're looking for, and let Mood help you discover your perfect mood. And don't forget to use promo code SPECIALISTS when you check out to save 20% on your first order. Try it today at mood.com.
Movie Buff Specialist Phil and John are back as we continue counting down our favorite 100 films of all time. Today we are on number 14, episode number 87. We're talking about Mirror from 1975 and Chinatown from 1974. If you haven't seen us in a while because you're a fan on this channel of the Survivor Specialist, and that's what you listen to generally, Survivor season is back, which maybe means you're back and you're going to be tuning in a little bit more now as we go through these final 14 episodes of this series, which we will be able to finish pretty much right in line with Survivor finishing unless John or I really can't do something for a month. But exciting times ahead. We are definitely in the home stretch. I really started to feel it this one where I already started to feel the nostalgia for this, John, even though we still have numerous weeks left. But I was already starting to think like, man, when we started this, who would have thought? And I found myself like, man, we watched Les Mis and The Descendants and look how far we've come now. I don't think either one would. Do you think Les Mis will still end up on your top 100?
No,
probably not. Right. Look at that. Our the first movies we ever did on this podcast aren't even going to be on our top 100 by the time this is all said and done. But anyway, Mirror by Andre Tarkovsky and Chinatown by Roman Polanski. So this was my first time watching Mirror. There's a lot to take in, so I'm happy I have John here to speak Russian to me because I didn't know what was going on for a good vast majority of that movie. Whereas Chinatown, it keeps you in the dark the way film noirs do, but it's a very straightforward movie. So I think it's fun when we have this dichotomy here of we have Mirror, which doesn't have a plot. And what a lie the Criterion Collection is telling by putting on the back of that. When a man finds out he's 40 years old and dying, I'm like, I didn't even know there was a man who was 40 year old in this movie. Like, what are you talking about? Like, so that, and then we have, of course, Chinatown, which is, you know, just a bunch of, it's pretty much how Los Angeles was made. So John, I know you're going to Los Angeles in a couple weekends. Now you can walk around and you'll know more history about that city than the people who have probably grown up there their entire lives. So
of course,
yeah, Chinatown is pretty much about the rise of Los Angeles as a city, being that it was next to inconsumable water. But let's talk about Mirror first, because there's really no way that that is a more popular movie than Chinatown. John, I know you're a big BFI fan, and this one came in high on the BFI list, right? I think both the directors and the critics list, or was it just one of them?
I think the critics list had it lower this time around, if I remember correctly, because it used to be a lot higher. Both, like, Mirror used to be around that 2021 mark, which is where Chinatown falls on the AFI list, which I thought was really funny. But on the latest list that was just released, Mirror dropped down to 31, which I think is kind of blasphemous, obviously, because I have it at 14. But yeah, it's a movie that's really popular. Tarkovsky is kind of like one of those directors that everyone talks about. We talked about one of his films so far. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we talked about Ivan's Childhood previously. This is your third Tarkovsky film you've watched, though, right, Phil?
Yeah, because I watched Solaris as well. So I'm starting to get a little bit more accustomed to his style and what he's all about. I don't believe I watched another one. I think those are the only three. Yeah, they are.
And I haven't watched his later works. I haven't watched Nostalgia or The Sacrifice yet. But Mir is that type of movie where you sit down and watch Mir for the first time. And you don't, like you said, you don't really know what's happening in this film. You kind of get a vague idea. You get the idea that someone's like reminiscing on things. It's a reflection on life. Surprise. That's why it's called Mir. And it's just juxtaposed with this beautiful imagery that Tarkovsky captures in this film. And the way Tarkovsky frames everything, where it has this feeling of surrealism to it that feels like it is a memory and that you don't quite know what's going on. We have those weird, bizarre scenes in this movie, like the mother levitating above the bed. And it's like, okay, what's happening here? And you kind of realize throughout the film, or maybe you don't, that we have this narrator, Alexei, who is dying. He's a middle-aged boy. He realizes he's dying. He's reflecting on his relationship with his mother and his mother's life, his own life, and kind of Russia as a whole, which is also another cool thing about this movie, where we get these interjections of historical footage of World War II, of like Maoist China, and it all comes together to just hit you and make you also kind of reflect on everything around you and reflect on your knowledge of events that happen and the perspectives other people have of them as well.
Yeah, it's funny that we're talking about Mir and Chinatown at the same time, because they're two movies that really have to take place where they are set. They can't take place anywhere else, even though Mir's story isn't like a coherent one. Like, I don't know what the proper word is there, but it's not a straightforward story. Saying it's incoherent makes it sound bad, right? But that's not what I'm saying. Is it's not a coherent story. It's not cohesive. But it's funny because next week we go to Fargo and Dr. Strangelove, which are also very much have to be done during the time period and during in that setting. And these are two movies that are very much, they have to be done during this time period because the reflections of what Russia was like growing up and all that really play heavily into this. When this movie came out, the Russian critics hated this movie. They did not like it. They were like not sold on Tarkovsky. And if I was Tarkovsky, I would have been worried about getting killed at that time. 1975, he made a movie that's like not very positive towards the Soviet Union. Like, I don't know. I don't know if I would have been too excited walking around the streets of what is now Russia. But he creates a really beautiful movie. And even though there's a lot of it that I'm sitting there and I'm like, I don't understand it. I don't know why the ordering of this had to be like this. I don't know who our main character is half the time. I guess it's the mother, because it's really not him. Whoever the 40-year-old dying is that I was lied about, that's not the main character of this movie. I don't care. Really, the main character of this movie is kind of you, because there's a lot of breaking of the fourth wall to make you get pulled into this story. But yeah. I really love what he does, the musical decisions. There's some moments it kind of has that man with a movie camera feel to it, where it doesn't really matter what you're watching, or it doesn't really matter what the greater meaning of each scene is, because it's just beautifully crafted. And this is definitely, like, out of the Tarkovsky I've watched so far, this is the one I feel I'll probably revisit the most, because I feel like there's the most to gain from multiple viewings. Whereas, like, Ivan's Childhood is a phenomenal movie, but I don't know if I'm going to watch that one all that often. One, because it's super depressing. But two, because you kind of get the story with that. Solaris, I think, definitely has a lot of a depth, and there's a lot that you can pull from that movie upon, rewatches and all that. However, this is just more compelling to me. I feel like the sci-fi genre has been done so many times now, especially with this other planets and space travel and all of that. Mirror is very unique, just very, very unique. And I struggle to even find a comparative movie for it.
I think that's because there isn't really a comparative movie for it. It's really its own thing. And the way it's presented, I wrote down in my notes this time that I think while watching Mir, it just feels like Tarkovsky is the closest a director has ever come to just capturing the essence of visual art on film. Mm-hmm. And like we talked about like Barry Lyndon, which has, you know, these literal like paintings as shots that Kubrick puts there, and it still just doesn't compare to what Tarkovsky does with the shots he puts in this movie.
Because with Barry Lyndon, there's literal paintings, but mm-hmm. we're being told a very straightforward story. That's the point, right? And the decision to have the poetry go in throughout this movie, right? Where like the poet will just read off, you know, stanzas from his work or whatever it is. That shows that this is meant to be poetic, right? Like this, there isn't meant to be more of a story than what we're seeing on the screen and what we're seeing unfold. And I just think like those are the types of things that make this more of an artsy movie, because in a lot of artsy movies, will have a straightforward story but look beautiful. I think of like a movie like The Favorite, Barry Lyndon. Those are two very straightforward movies, even if they are very artsy. And then you'll get these pretentious mumbo jumbo movies, which I don't like, but I'm talking like Shane Carruth, who I bring up all the time in a negative light on this podcast, because I think his movies stink. I think they're boring. I think they're so self-indulgent. And I don't think they actually are getting across the point that he thinks he's so smartly bringing across. But he's doing it super, super artistically, like so over the top artistically. And I feel like in that middle ground between these two things is something like this movie. I say this a lot, whether I'm talking about this or I'm talking about Survivor, whichever podcast I'm doing, but I say this a lot. I don't think sometimes people understand what makes something work. We talked about that with Reservoir Dogs. We talked about that with other Tarantino. We talked about that last week when I was talking about Erica winning Survivor 41. I don't think people really understand what makes certain elements of film resonate. And we see all the time with, after Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind came out, all of a sudden everybody was going to be able to make this like cool, unique love story where it's not told in chronological order and it gets like super heady and all that. But what is it really getting to the heart of? What made Eternal Sunshine special compared to the rest of them? And I think Mirror brings up a fascinating question with that, because even though Mirror is not, because it was a Russian film in 1975 or a Soviet film in 1975, it didn't garner the same type of acclaim that a Fellini would have garnered or something along those lines if it came out at the exact same time. And I feel that Soviet Russian film hasn't made its way into the mainstream the way that Italian or French cinema or any, like, those are really the two that I think are like the biggest ones. German has started to do that a little bit more, but then even then, a lot of the times the German directors end up directing English movies after a while. Yeah. So all that being said, I think that's why a movie like Mirror might not come up in that conversation as often, but it does raise fascinating questions about like, what can you accomplish through the medium of film? And this movie accomplishes a hell of a lot without telling you much, because this I could have easily fallen asleep to if it wasn't done as well as it's done. Like, this is a very easy movie to say, I don't get it, I'm done, I'm not watching anymore.
Yeah, but I think it really falls into that poetic aspect of it, because I think that using his father's poetry, because the poems in this are all Tarkovsky's father's poetry, mm-hmm. recited by his father. I think by using that poetry and the way that all of these shots are demonstrated to us, the whole point is like we were saying, like how this is more artistic than a lot of film is because Tarkovsky's not telling us how we're supposed to feel about everything. Mm-hmm. And that's something that a lot of films do too much of, where they're like telling you, okay, you're supposed to feel sad now, you're supposed to feel happy now. And Tarkovsky just puts something on the screen in this film and lets you say, how does this make you feel?
Yeah.
And I think it's really interesting that this film starts with this speech therapy, like hypnosis session, essentially, where Tarkovsky just like predicates everything in this film on the idea of, okay, we're going to release the tension and you're going to be able to speak clearly. And I think that's what he's really trying to do with this film, is just let us speak clearly about everything around us.
Yeah. And I think a lot of, you know, what's so hard about movies with memory and things like that is Tarkovsky wasn't setting out to make a nostalgic film.
No.
But he also wasn't setting... Go ahead.
That's his other film, Nostalgia.
Yeah, okay. So very on the nose. Yeah. See, John doesn't like artists. John likes people who are on the nose. But he froze there, so I don't know if he can see that I'm smiling as I say that. But it's a very... He's not setting out to make that kind of movie, because we talked about Midnight in Paris a couple weeks ago, and that is such a nostalgic movie. That is very much like, what does this time period mean to you? And I think what's fun about this movie is Tarkovsky lets you know that things weren't great in the Soviet Union during the war and whatever was happening after the war, and that they're still not great in 1975. But he's also allowing you to see the beauty of everything that's going on in this place and those things that you do miss. And, you know, now every time he dreams of his mother, she always looks like his now wife or girlfriend or whatever it is. Like it's very interesting how he's pulled the questions that he's raising without really ever raising a question. Because if you were to sit down and say, what is Mirror about? Like, if you had to write that log line, because this was going to go on HBO Max.
Yeah.
I don't fault them for saying a man who's dying finds out he's dying at the age of 40, reminisces on his life. But that's not what this movie is about. Like, that is not the plot of this movie in any way, shape, or form. I don't think you find out that he's dying until the very last scene of the movie, because up until then, here he's got the cough or whatever, but you don't know he's dying until they say, oh, he's dying. Well, what's he dying of? Nothing. Like, really, he's dying because he's miserable. Like, that's what he's dying of. And I think that, you know, it's cool questions like that are being raised by Tarkovsky about we tell this story to ourselves about our pasts and what it means to live where we live and that identity that brings with it. But how much of that is real? How much of that is just dream? How much of that is made up, like, in our own heads? And then, like, I don't know. He just exhibits it beautifully throughout from beginning to end. And he even, like, puts his finger into, you know, what was his mother doing and what were all these different moments in her life like? And what about when the fire happened at the barn? Did that even happen on the same day that you think this happened? Because he associates it with those, but she's claiming it wasn't even the same day. And then you just sit there and you say, okay, what is the point of living? What is my life meant to be? And this movie goes to the point of, well, I'm just going to die at the age of 40 or whatever, because that's just what needs to happen.
Yeah. And we kind of get this hypothesis on, like, life in general in this scene on the fence. When Masha's sitting on the fence at the fence, and the doctor comes up, and then he sits down and he falls, and he's talking about the trees and how the trees, you know, we need to kind of learn from the trees, because they're just there, and they just live, and they take in the world around them, and how we don't do that a lot. And then throughout the rest of the film, we kind of see this go, go, go mentality, a lot of it, right? Like, I think of the contrast from that conversation to the printing press scene, and how Masha's running down there, so worried she has this error that she put in there, and it's just running, trying to figure everything out, and it's not taking those moments to just breathe and think about what's going on. And I think that's really what Tarkovsky's kind of trying to get to here, even when he mentions things like Russia's impact on European history and how Russia's not that impactful to it from what Europeans see, but Russians know that they held off, like, the Mongol hordes.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, protected the Christian world from non-Christianity and stuff like that. It's just, it's fascinating that Tarkovsky somehow is able to make us think about just this larger picture of life while showing us such mundane things happening.
Yeah, and I feel like those thoughts that Tarkovsky puts in here are very, like, Western thoughts. You know, like, because a lot of Eastern thoughts in Russia, I mean, Soviet Union at the time, being a communist country, was very much like, it was about Everybody. It wasn't about you, not how could you individually do something. It was you fit in, you conform, you do this certain specific way, and that's it. And those types of questions, kind of thinking about what's Russia's place in the grand scheme of everything. Where's our credit for certain things, right? Which wasn't really what Russia was. That's not really what Russia was promoting. Russia wanted to be a world power. And, you know, obviously living in the U.S., U.S. versus Russia in the 80s is obviously a big part of our culture. The 70s and 80s of, you know, the Red Scare. I mean, that was a big deal. But you very rarely hear that Russian stance of why don't we get appreciated? Because it's almost like it's such a proud country that it doesn't need to be appreciated. Right? It's the Lannister feeling of lions don't concern themselves with sheep. But Tarkovsky is raising that anyway in this movie, which kind of gets deeper into just like being Russian, being part of the Soviet Union and all of that. Like, I don't know. It's very interesting and different from what in the couple of Russian movies I've seen. I mean, I've only seen three Tarkovsky, but because I've done this podcast with you and because I've been alive, I've seen a bunch of Russian movies at this point.
Yeah.
That's not something you ever see in Russian movies.
No, it's not. And I think it's really interesting that Tarkovsky frames it this way. I don't know if you noticed this, but the scene where we have Alexei on the phone with his mom, mm-hmm. Which is right after the barn burns down.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when she tells him, you know, right? Liza died and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
Did you notice that in that apartment, there is a poster for Tarkovsky's Andrei Rublev, but it's in English?
Yep, I did see that.
So Tarkovsky's even kind of proposing this idea of the separation between Europe and Russia here within himself.
Mm-hmm.
And how that reflects on the work that he's making. It's just so interesting.
Yeah, it's funny because there's so much thought going into this movie. And for Tarkovsky, I mean, Tarkovsky made, at least from what I've seen, he's made some very strange movies, and then he's made some very straightforward movies. You know, like Mirror is not a straightforward movie, but Ivan's Childhood is. Solaris falls in the middle somewhere there, right? Like it's got more to it, but it's a pretty easy to follow story. It's just what are the deeper meanings that are being pushed. This one feels so much more epic than it really is, I think, because of how personal of a movie it is for him.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of times that's what comes across, right? Like when you get a writer and a director and they're writing and directing the same movie, sometimes you're going to get garbage, but sometimes you're also going to get some of your greatest movies ever made, which happens a lot with Paul Thomas Anderson and Wes Anderson and things along those lines, because it's so personal to you. You want it to be so specifically done a certain way because you can visualize it in your head and everything like that. Like, so the Criterion Collection that I have with this, and I haven't looked at it yet, but I really want to, and I thought I was going to have time before this podcast, but I didn't. It came with their pitch for this movie. And it's like a 60-page thing in the Criterion Collection. And the pitch is essentially this. Like, it is essentially what went out on film. If Tarkovsky wasn't well known at that point, this movie doesn't get made. It doesn't get made, right? Because who was going to accept that type of pitch from an unknown? I don't think it was going to happen.
And even then, like, this is only his fourth film?
So it was that early in his career.
It was that... He only made 7 feature-length films. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's his 5th film. It's like his middle career. Because it's...
He had done Andrei Rublev. He had done Solaris. He had done Ivan's Childhood.
So this is his 4th film. This is his middle film.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I think you're right. I think this is... But the other thing we have to keep in mind is the Soviet Union also was so... huge into film as an art. The Soviet Union, like right from the get-go, Lenin declared film as the national art form of the Soviet Union. And because of that, and because of, you know, some of the greatest film directors of all time, with like Eisenstein, and then you have Tarkovsky come along, and Tarkovsky is the best Russian director since Eisenstein. And he is creating these films. You kind of give him a little bit of leeway with this one, despite the fact that you don't really know, but you're also promoting poetry of a renowned Russian poet at the same time.
Yeah, and so what do you think happened? I mean, now this is obviously a bigger question, but what do you think ended up happening with Russian film? That just, because Russian films don't get that much notoriety anymore. I mean, even you, what was the last time you watched a Russian, like a movie that was Russian? What's the most recent Russian film you watched?
The most recent Russian film probably was about 10 years ago.
Right? Like...
And I think a lot of it comes down to, like, Russia kind of made their own, like, Hollywood-esque type film industry, where it's a lot of, like, big action movies now.
Mm-hmm.
So we're not getting the... I mean, we occasionally get these, like, intimate Russian films.
Like The Return.
Yeah, right? Like, we get them, but they're fewer and far between, and it's kind of just, like, the same way that American... They have kind of gotten to the point where they're approaching cinema the same way that the Americans are approaching it.
Yeah, but there's like a lot less being funded into like artsy Russian films than there are with artsy American. Because even though, I mean, every indie director and every indie filmmaker will tell you that they don't have enough money, because they don't. But still, they're being able to make these movies. That's not really happening in Russia, it doesn't feel like. I mean, The Return is seriously the most recent one that I can think of from Russia that's like that like made any type of impact in America. And that was 2003.
Yeah. I don't know. I think a lot of it comes down to that. I think we just don't hear about a lot. I think we as North Americans don't hear a lot of what comes out of Russia. Mm-hmm. And I think it kind of stems to back with the Cold War and everything, mm-hmm. where we weren't seeing a lot come out. And we kind of had at the end of the 80s and stuff with Gorbachev and like kind of opening up Russian culture to the world, we kind of got an influx of things. But since then, I think Russia's gotten a little more closed off, and we're not easily accessing these Russian art forms that are coming up.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just, it's interesting, because back in the 70s, these types of movies were still making an impact. I mean, a movie like Solaris got a George Clooney remake not long after. I mean, yeah, 20 something years after, but that's not that long in the scheme of life and film and all that. And this was probably during the time where there was the most doubt in Russia and Soviet Union and all of that from the rest of the world. The rest of the world thought Russia was out to get them, and they were going to go for world domination and kill everybody and whatever. But these movies by Tarkovsky were still making their impact. And I just find it interesting that you're probably right. It is definitely for political reasons that we don't hear more about Russian films. And who knows who is pushing that more, whether that's Russia not wanting their movies to go out into America, and I mean that as North America, or if North America wants nothing to do with Russian films, I don't know.
Yeah.
But I do know that we don't see or hear about them nearly as much. And a director like Tarkovsky, you know, who was so ahead of his time in so many ways, really also had to have been at that time, though, because had he not been around until the 90s, I don't think anybody would have given a shit.
It's tough. I watched Mir, and I felt like there are some Lynchian qualities to this film.
Mm-hmm, I agree with that.
There are moments where like you're watching it. I think to like the woman in the apartment with the cup of tea or whatever it is she's drinking. Mm-hmm. Like that entire sequence felt so Lynchian to me this time while watching it, and I realized that, I mean, Lynch probably like. I would imagine Lynch has probably watched a couple Tarkovsky films and probably like recognizes that in his works. This, to me, it just feels like if Tarkovsky came around later, would he still be making Russian films?
That's a good point. Well, so I've been looking while we've been talking, and Andrei Zvigetsnev, I have no idea, but he's the one who did The Return. He also did Leviathan, and then he did Loveless. And Loveless is actually the one that's probably the most popular. That came out in 2017, though, so still 6 years ago. But that one, so he is like the director, though. If you're looking for Russian film, he's kind of that guy now. But I think that's a very fair point of would he still be making those movies? Because you even see that with somebody like Ang Lee, right? Ang Lee, phenomenal director, coming straight out of Hong Kong, was doing great, but couldn't make the career he wanted just making movies in Hong Kong. So that's why he branched out, and he's making movies like Life of Pi and, you know, I mean, Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon was his, you know, big moment, but after that, how much longer is he going to be able to do it? You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's a big point. Like, it's just, it's really interesting to kind of meditate on that with film and the like state of film now is, I mean, even with, we've been talking about the Oscars and the Oscar noms and stuff, and we're seeing this, I mean, one of the biggest things with the international films list this year is that RRR didn't get nominated, right? For best international film because India didn't submit it. And like, are we still in a point where we're viewing cinema on a global expanse that like each country can only produce one film every year?
One great and movie, right?
It's fascinating, especially when you consider like the wide range of different types of cinema that all of these other countries have that we don't see. The fact that like Japan had never submitted an anime for best international film until like last year or something like that. Like, it just seems that we're just so honed in on American and like to an extent, again, those like French and Italian films that we just kind of ignore the rest of the world a little too much.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's just because Hollywood is the big moneymaker when it comes to film and, you know, at least for what is a very rich country. And where movie stars and everything like that are so massive. So it makes sense. But it's funny. That's like this whole conversation, though, because Mirror isn't a movie that is plot driven. It is a movie that is thoughtful and wanting you to think about where it stands in the grand scheme of everything else. And
exactly.
I think that's why this movie came out a year after Chinatown. Came out the same year One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest won Best Picture, and the year before Rocky would win Best Picture, the year after The Godfather 2 would win Best Picture. How, like, where did a movie like this fit into America? It didn't. It did not fit into American audience. 1975 could be one of the, could be the greatest year for American film ever. With Dog Day Afternoon, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, Nashville, Barry Lyndon, and Jaws. Like, those are the five movies nominated for Best Picture that year. None of them are like Mirror. Now, Robert Altman with Nashville, that's a different kind of movie. But none of them are like Mirror.
No, no. And like, that's what's so nice about viewing these other movies. And like, I'm so happy that I decided at the, you know, ripe old age of 18 to take Slavic studies in university. So I was introduced to these type of films because I don't know how long it would have taken me to watch a Tarkovsky film if I hadn't.
Yeah.
And Mir gets announced for the Criterion Collection. And the day it gets announced, I pre-order it. Like, that's what this does. Like, I don't know. And watching it again and just like seeing these moments, the barn burning scene is so gorgeous. And the fact that you don't see it out first and the first time you see it is through this reflection in a mirror, it just really makes you think about everything that's going on and the fact that this is a memory and that you're not quite sure what's happening. And it just impacts you so much harder every time you watch it.
Yeah, I know. I really do want to, like, that is a movie that I will definitely be rewatching in the near future because it's just, it needs another watch. It's just not possible to take it all in after one. It's just not possible.
I mean, I've seen it several times now and I still need to watch it more.
Yeah. It's kind of, it's kind of like when I would always talk about with Memento, where Memento did what it wanted to do so well, because by the end of it, you forget how it's going to end every time you watch it, because even though you've seen it so many times, you forget how it gets to those points. I feel like that's like a movie like Mirror just has that.
Absolutely.
Yeah. But, all right. What was the best thing you watched this week?
I've been kind of making my way through the Oscar noms this week. And like, I've been watching some of those like weird one-off nominees this week. None of them really stuck out to me. So I think I actually have to go with a new M. Night Shyamalan movie was the best thing I watched this week. Knock at the Cabin. It's getting very mixed reviews. It's pretty straightforward for an M. Night Shyamalan movie. The symbolism's apparent if you understand what it's about, but might take a few people a little longer to pick up on. more importantly, I think it really just showcases Dave Bautista's acting skills, which are a lot better than I think most people expected. It was good. I really enjoyed it. It was very, it kind of had some mirror qualities to it, where it was very self-reflective, and Sean Wan frames a lot of things in kind of in the first person, where you're not sure which character's being spoken to, but it's a lot of like centering the character who's speaking at you, and kind of feels like the character's talking to you, and it makes you think a lot. It was just a very different type of M. Night Shyamalan movie.
Yeah, that's on my list of movies to watch. I actually kind of liked Old. I thought Old was, you know, fine. I mean, M. Night Shyamalan, my expectations are so low for him at this point, especially since, like I've said numerous times on this podcast, The Sixth Sense, I don't think holds up at all. So with all that being said, he's definitely, you know, I know what I'm going into with his movies, and I think that's why I liked Old, and I'm curious to see what Knock at the Cabin was. So I watched Dr. No and Puss in Boots: The Last Wish. Those are the only two movies I watched. And I will say, I think Puss in Boots: The Last Wish was good, but I think it's so overrated. It's crazy. Like, I gave it 3 stars, but the way people are talking about this movie, you would think it was the greatest animated movie to ever come out. And I do think that there were some really interesting moments. I thought the death dog was awesome. I mean, I thought that whole thing was creepy as hell. But I don't know. Like, I feel like it gave away a lot of the fun of the first one to have more depth. Cause the first one has no depth. I mean, the first one is all surface level, whatever, but it's fun. This one I felt was a little bit less fun, but had the depth. And then Dr. No, probably my least favorite or second least favorite of the Sean Connery Bonds, but it was much better on this viewing than I remembered it being the last time. And maybe I just had misplaced expectations the last time I watched it, but you know, it's a good movie. I mean, it's entertaining. It's the movie before From Russia with Love, and From Russia with Love is my second favorite Bond. So it just kind of is what it is. But yeah, that's it.
Yep. I have that. Dr. No doesn't quite feel like it has that Bond formula to it. It's missing a lot of the Bond aspects. And I think people sometimes go into it with that misconception of this is a James Bond movie, when it's like, it's not heavy gadgety. It's not even like James Bond as kind of like the character we know James Bond doesn't really quite come through in that movie. I definitely feels like they're still trying to like figure out what they're doing at that point.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, you know, and I mean, you have to set the tone, right? Like, you have to figure it out early on. So it's just, you know, what did they think James Bond was going to be? They didn't know it was going to become this like over the top, super fun, all of that. But just give me 1 second. If you want to just talk for like 2 minutes, I just need to fix something real quick.
But even then, like with James Bond and Dr. No, it's so important to see where it comes from. And I mean, I went on that journey, was that last year or the year before? It's been so long. Whenever No Time to Die came out, I watched all of the James Bond movies chronologically, and it's so important to start with Dr. No, because you see where these things that the rest of the franchise capitalizes on came from and started from, and how everything started and how it ended. But I do understand what you're also saying about Puss in Boots. Like, that movie has, I enjoyed it. I also gave it 3 stars, I think. I don't know. And we'll talk about this more when we get to like our Oscar prediction show. But animated feature is such a hard category to like figure out how voters are going to vote, I find, because a lot of it falls into like the animation side of things. And I think Puss in Boots feels like it has like a bit more unique of animation style, and it feels like it has a lot of depth to it, because it's kind of talking about this idea of coming to terms with mortality, which is weird because it's not the only picture nominated for best animated picture this year that has that theme, but it still feels kind of childish, and it's so hard to really figure out how that category gets graded because of that.
Yeah, I mean, you had a movie like Soul win it a couple of years ago, right? I mean, that's all about dying. I mean, that's literally what a ghost.
Yeah, maybe the Oscars just really like movies about people dying.
They love depressing movies. If you go look at every movie that won Best Picture from the 90s, somebody died.
Yeah.
Even in Forrest Gump. Forrest Gump might not die, but Jenny sure as hell got AIDS. Like, it's crazy. Like every movie in the 90s, somebody, one of the main characters was dying. I think the only one where a main character doesn't die in the 90s when it wins Best Picture, there's two of them. Shakespeare in Love, which is a comedy, so that makes sense. And the other one is Silence of the Lambs. Anyway, it's a fun thing to think about when you sit down and you really think about that. But let's talk about Chinatown from 1974. Yes. So Chinatown came out in that one of those busy, busy, busy years of the 70s, lost Best Picture to Godfather Part Two. Just, you know, the 70s every year was always so crowded. But this movie was Roman Polanski was setting out to make like an ode to classic Hollywood film noirs, right? Like that's all he was trying to do. He's trying to make one of these like 1940s type movies, but make it about the birth of Los Angeles, you know, like how Los Angeles came to be, how they were going to get the water for people and the, you know, actually have food and sustain and all that. Cause they're surrounded by a desert. And in like you come out and you try to make this mimicry and end up making one of the best film noirs ever made. I think it's the best film noir ever made, but it does such a great job of capturing what made those 40s films classic, putting a 70s spin on it and having a storyline that is just so, so, so good. I mean, the story is great. The backstabbings are great. Jack Nicholson is one of the best Snoops in this. J.J. Gittes is such a great Snoop. All of the side characters work because they all have different motives. Nobody really knows what's going on, why things are going in certain ways. I love all of that stuff. And to me, this is just one of the best screenplays ever written. Now, if you go on the internet, they nitpick the crap out of the screenplay because everything that's considered great has to be nitpicked like crazy. But this movie is so well plotted. It is insane. Like every single thing from the fake Evelyn Mulray walking into the house the first time to it's bad for glass. All of that stuff. Like it is so incredibly well plotted. There are so many little things that are hinted at early on in this movie that you don't find out till later. It's one of my favorite movies to watch along with and play along to. And it does something that people don't realize is almost in no movie. Jack Nicholson is in every single scene of this movie. Then that doesn't mean he's the star of every scene of this movie. He's not in every shot of this movie, but he is in every single scene of this movie. That almost never happens in a movie, even a film noir. Because a lot of times you'll get the scene with the femme fatale talking to somebody else, or you'll get the side characters. Whatever it is, there's always kind of something different that gets shown to give you some exposition or some plot. Jack Nicholson is in every single scene of this movie.
Yeah.
When you watch movies though, John, now when you watch movies, think about that, because you're going to realize very few movies are like that.
Yeah. The interesting thing I felt about Chinatown and why I think it's like kind of this like pinnacle of the noir genre and how it's not just this ode to it. Every single reveal in this film feels like a revelation. Like every single moment you're just like, oh my god, what? Because even when we first get Faye Dunaway's the actual Mrs. Mulray come in and you're like, wait a minute, that's not the woman who was here before. What's going on? And you're like piecing it together and you have these like small reveals and these revelations, and then you get to, you know, the big stuff towards the end of you know, Evelyn was raped by her father, had a child, and now, you know, trying to escape her father, who's clearly not a good dude.
Yeah.
It's fascinating because it doesn't feel, sometimes in film noirs, you can get to a point where a reveal either feels so obvious, it doesn't feel relevant, or it feels so unnecessary, it doesn't feel relevant. And Chinatown doesn't do that. Polanski was very succinct in exactly what information he reveals when in this movie, and it just makes it for such a wild ride the entire way through.
Yeah, and it's such a dark movie because so much of this movie is about how are the people of Los Angeles going to get the water they need, and it's being diverted, and we're going to look into that, and that's why it seems like Hollis Mulray gets murdered and all that. And what you really realize by the end of this movie is nobody cares about the regular people of Los Angeles. That's what the message of this movie is, right? Like that whole ending of Forget It, Jake, It's Chinatown, one of the most dissected lines ever. And I go back and forth. What does it really mean? What is the takeaway from that line? And watching it this time, my thought was, when he was in Chinatown, he did everything he could to not have a girl get killed, and she got killed anyway. And he was a beat cop, and he moved on, and now he's a private investigator. It just, life went on. And now in this situation, he does everything he can so this girl doesn't get killed. She ends up getting killed anyway. Okay, so it's like a replay of Chinatown. It's taking place in Chinatown, all of those things. But really, it's more of saying this isn't going to matter in the long run. Because Cross is too big to take down. And the water system and the people who run the water department are going to do what they do no matter how corrupt it is. There's nothing you can do about it. And it's such a bleak ending. It's so bleak because it's just this whole movie, you think, okay, he's going to find out something. He's going to take down Noah Cross. And all you end up finding is how bad all of these people are and how they keep winning. And that's the note it ends on. And that's why I think the reveals are so great in this movie, because the reveals are all powerful to what the story means as a whole. The reveal that the people in the nursing home are buying all this land because they can just do it. And this was back during the 40s when it was pretty easy to scam the hell out of people. Like we're seeing that the people who are in the obituaries, they're having all the land. All that's doing, though, is building up how horrible of a person Noah Cross is and the other people who he works with for whatever. That's all it's doing. That's why this movie, I think, is so great, because if you really think about everything that Jack Nicholson looks into, doesn't matter to anything in this movie. Like, it does not matter. All these big discoveries, all these big revelations, they all amount to nothing. Because at the end of the day, all he's trying to do is protect Evelyn Mulray. Mm-hmm. He can't do it. Because how do you protect? And that's like the I feel like that's the metaphor for everybody is trying to. Hollis Mulray was trying to protect the people of Los Angeles. And so he got killed for it, because at the end of the day, nobody cares about the people of Los Angeles. They care about where the money's coming from. Can I get that promotion? What's his name? The guy, his partner, Hollis Mulray, the guy who's under Hollis Mulray. He moves right up into the nice, nice, beautiful office. That's what makes great film noir, right? Because that's black film. That is black film. That is dark, disturbing, no light, no happiness. And that's how it should be. And Chinatown captures that while maintaining incredible levels of entertainment. And Jack Nicholson's performance is just like out of control. Great. He is so charismatic in this role. That's what I have to say about just the grand scheme of the revelations and everything.
Yeah. And I mean, even when I look at it, the way it's structured, with the fact that like Chinatown's kind of this word that gets bandied around a lot, but we don't really see anything about Chinatown for a long time in the film. And even like, oh, they're down in Chinatown and stuff like that. It has this weird connotation to it. Where it's like, okay, but why is that a big deal? And yeah, we get the revelation about why, you know, Jake's no longer on the beat and stuff like that. He's no longer a cop. But even then, it's like, why Chinatown? Why is it Chinatown? Why is this movie called Chinatown? That's because nothing matters in Chinatown.
Yeah. 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 And what I love about this script by Robert Towne is you hear about Chinatown once in the first hour and a half, hour 15, whatever it is. He sleeps with Evelyn Mulray, and you probably hear the word Chinatown 40 times the rest of the movie. Yeah. It's brilliant, because as he is falling further and further into this cycle, it's bringing up his past and what all that means to him. And he's reminiscing on that other situation that we never get details about. We just know she died. That's all we know.
Yeah.
But it's so fresh on his mind, because now it's starting to take over. Now the situation's starting to play out again, and everything is going wrong. And will he learn from those mistakes or no? And instead, it doesn't really matter if he learns from them or not, because there's nothing he can do about it. Because the cop is the one who ends up killing Evelyn Mulray. And Noah Cross is hugging Catherine, pulling her out of the car as this movie is ending. And there's nothing that J.J. Geddes can do. It's just, it's, I don't know. It's just brilliant. It's just brilliant. So I love those decisions, because you could have done this the way a lot of film noirs do it. You know, I even think about Maltese Falcon with the ending of it's the stuff that dreams are made of. That's not a downer ending. The whole movie, they're just running around in circles looking for this priceless artifact that's not priceless, but it's not a downer ending. L.A. Confidential has an upbeat ending, right? And I love L.A. Confidential. That's an upbeat ending. A lot of Humphrey Bogart movies have more upbeat endings. Or there's somebody's coming out hopeful, even if everything else is going wrong. It's just not the case in this movie.
No, it's not. And it feels like throughout the film, you're not even meant to believe that good things are going to happen. Mm-hmm. Just the way everything's framed. And I think a lot of that comes down to the way that, like, these characters don't feel like film characters a lot of the time. Mm-hmm. They feel more like real people. And I think that comes down to the way Polanski frames the actors in his shots. Even when the actors aren't at the forefront of a shot, it always feels like they're where your attention should be in this movie.
Yeah, I agree with that. They all own the screen when they're on it. This is a movie that had to be shot in Los Angeles. Yep. And it had to be during this era. But every character is more important than the actual location. I mean, even Hollis Mulray, when Giddes is following him around, you get the low angle hero shots of Hollis Mulray most of that time. You know, when it's not the Snoop shots, when it's not point of view from Jack Nicholson, a lot of them are the hero shots. Noah Cross is barely in this movie. John Huston is in this movie for 10 minutes, if that. It's two scenes. He's in technically three scenes. He's in the Chinatown scene. He's in the scene when him and Jack Nicholson meet the first time. And then he's in the scene where Jack Nicholson brings him in before they go to Chinatown. So it's all he's in. What an imposing figure, though. Just a huge imposing figure. Evelyn Mulray is such an imposing. We don't even see the real Evelyn Mulray until a half hour into this movie. Mm-hmm. And yet that character is relevant in your mind because you're hearing the name. It's so hard for writers to put the music in your ears, right? Because, you know, you're introducing too many characters at one time, or you're doing this, or you're doing that. But when you have these upper level performances, you're not going to forget who any of these people are as the movie's going on.
No. And I mean, with Evelyn's such an interesting character because you also have the association to the genre attached to her. And that's one of the big things with noir, and why I think this is such a beautiful homage to noir, and why it kind of transcends homage and is just like considered one of the classic noirs, is because you have these character archetypes that are so prevalent in noir. You know, you have the PI who's, you know, at the end quite altruistic and doing things not selfishly, but doing them for some sort of greater good. And you have the femme fatale who's usually in on it and stuff. And when we start the film and we have Jake set up where we have the fake Evelyn Mulray come in and insist that he finds out that what Mr. Mulray's doing and like how Hollis is cheating on her and everything. But Jake in that conversation is like, you know what, you shouldn't do this. It's just better just to ignore it. And, like, we get that altruism from him. But in the end, everything he does in this movie is so selfish. Everything is because of who, like, it's all for himself. And it's not this altruism of falling for the femme fatale or anything like that. Although that does happen, we get this idea that he's doing this because of himself and, like, what happened previously to him. This is a redemption for himself. It's nothing to do with anyone else in this film.
I was just going to say one of the biggest tells with that is when he finds out about getting the money. When he decides what he's going to charge Evelyn Mulray, because she says however much money is made, he goes, well, you know, this won't be easy on your pocketbook. He hasn't mentioned money to anybody until that moment. It's great, but go ahead.
Yeah, and then Evelyn Mulray, to have the femme fatale not really introduced until half an hour into this film, it catches you off guard, and it's kind of a subversion of the way the genre happens, because in a noir, you expect the femme fatale to be there at the very beginning of the film. Because the relationship between the femme fatale and the PI tends to be the most important aspect of the film noir. And when we are given a fake femme fatale who doesn't even look like a femme fatale, like doesn't have possess any of the qualities of the femme fatale, with the first, like the fake Mulray, you're caught off guard when you see Faye Dunaway and you're thinking, wait a minute, what's happening here? Like, why? Because I know going in that Faye Dunaway's in this film and I know she plays the femme fatale in this film. So I'm sitting there confused as to why I'm not seeing her until half an hour in.
Yeah. And that's just great setup, right? Because, you know, first of all, the first scene of this movie with him and Burt Young, and he's looking through the photos. I'll get to why that's so brilliant in a second. But we get that. And it's, what do you want me to do? Is she a good wife? Just go home. Who cares? Whatever, blah, blah, blah. Then it goes to the next scene. And I think my husband's cheating me. Oh, no, I'm so sorry. He's so bored with the work he's doing. It's awful. So he's taking it for granted. His guard is so down. His guard is so down in this moment. And it takes until he tells the Chinaman joke, which is what that is. He tells that joke. It takes until that moment for him to actually start to put his guard back up. Because until that point, he's annoyed. He's like, oh, you can't believe you print this in the paper, and he's fighting with people, but he wants the respect. He wants to be treated well. He's in it for himself, like you're saying, but his guard is so down because he knows that what he's doing ultimately isn't worthwhile. It's a waste of everybody's time. He's a schmuck. He is what he is. And so for him, it's that moment where his guard goes up. And it's also at that moment where our guard goes up, because until that moment, you don't really know where this movie is going. There's a lot of aimless snooping. It's whatever. I'm going to go see what's going on. Maybe I can find this. Maybe I can find that. But there's no, what do you call it? Like pace to it. It doesn't feel like, okay, this needs to happen right now. Or like, you know, there's no urgency. That's the word I'm looking for. All of a sudden when that happens, now it's okay. What else is wrong in this movie? Who is setting him up? How is he being set up? Hollis Mulray, like what is going on with what was his relationship with the wife? Who is this girl now? Like all of a sudden now there are so many more questions, and it's just brilliant, that setup, because Faye Dunaway at the time had been in Bonnie and Clyde. So it's not like people didn't know who Faye Dunaway is. If you were going to see this movie in 1974, you knew you were going to see a Jack Nicholson and Faye Dunaway movie. I mean, they were big enough names at that time. Although Dunaway might've actually been a bigger name than Nicholson, at that time, because really Nicholson with this and then One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, that's when he exploded, was with those two movies. But he had done like The Last Detail, which was good, Five Easy Pieces. Like he showed that he could act, but you knew Faye Dunaway was going to be a big role in this movie. You knew it. There was no question about it. And they had the confidence to just sit down and let the story play out the way it was going to. And then when Faye Dunaway does come in, you go, okay, what's her deal? Now you're questioning everybody. To get into the head of a character in a movie as well as Roman Polanski gets it into the head of J.J. Geddes is amazing. It's just like second to none. Because a lot of film noirs, they tell you the story. In this movie, the story unfolds with you. That's really hard to pull. That's hard to pull off with any kind of movie, but especially a mystery like this.
Mm-hmm. And especially to keep you guessing about who you can trust the entire time. Because, and again, it comes down to that Evelyn reveal of her showing up with her lawyer and wanting to sue for defamation. Because at that point, you thought you could trust this movie to tell you all the details. And then all of a sudden, it doesn't.
Yep.
And now you as an audience member are scrutinizing every single detail that comes out as to whether this is real or not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's, you're along for the ride. There was a sequel made to this movie, which is funny. Jared DiGirolamo over here says, The Two Jakes is the name of it. It came out in 1990. I never saw it, but it's got Harvey Keitel, Madeline Stowe, Eli Wallach. Like, it was written by, it's got what do you call it? Jack Nicholson. It was written by Robert Towne. The reviews on it are kind of what they are. It didn't make any money, really. I don't think a lot of people even realized that it was a sequel to Chinatown at the time, with it being called The Two Jakes. But anyway, I just wanted to kind of bring that up because it's funny that like this one does have such a succinct ending, and it's so iconic to like then say, okay, it's like making a sequel to Gone with the Wind after she says, "I'll never go hungry again," or whatever. Or no, frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn. It's like, why'd you, if he doesn't give a damn, why are we watching another movie about it? You know what I mean? Forget it, Jake, Chinatown, but like now we got to catch back up with where his life is. I've never seen it, but anyway, just this movie is just, the writing and the direction are just so freaking good. And there's some, you know, the snooping is what's great, because you feel the fear and you feel the confusion and you feel the frustration right alongside him. And that is what is so important to this movie. I want to talk about the Burt Young thing.
Okay.
You familiar with Burt Young, John? How familiar are you with Burt Young?
I'm not.
Okay, you're not. So Burt Young plays Adrian's brother, whatever, Paulie, in Rocky. So which came out 2 years after this, he plays that. So Burt Young at this time, from what I understand, and now I could be wrong, but from what I understand, wasn't a very big name when this movie came out. He'd been in like 5 or 6 movies. The only one I've heard of is The Gang That Couldn't Shoot Straight. And, you know, with Rocky, that was when he was nominated for Academy Award for Supporting Actor. And he's in a whole bunch of the Rocky movies and everything like that, blah, blah, blah. But so this first scene of the movie, being that Burt Young wasn't a well-known name at this time, we see the photographs of his wife sleeping with a police officer or whoever it is. And it's like, you know, it's ruining his life. At the time, this feels like a throwaway. So I always take, when I was in film school, I was always taught, use what you have. When you're writing, when you're directing, use what you have. And this went for everything, right? You're not going to be James Cameron and go make Avatar 2 because you don't have the money to go make Avatar 2. So what kind of budget do you have? Use what you have. Make a movie based around the budget that you have. But when you're writing a screenplay, use the characters that you've already established. And this is, in my estimation, the greatest example of this in film history. And this is one like where I say all the time, like this could be the best, or this is the best instance of that ever. In the first scene of this movie, Jack Nicholson and Burt Young are in that scene, and Burt Young finds out his wife is cheating on him. We think that's a throwaway scene. Who gives a damn? It's over. Now we're worried about the Mulrays. We're worried about Hollis Mulray. All that that scene was telling us was, okay, we needed to see that Jack Nicholson's bored with his job. Mm-hmm. And then an hour and 35 minutes into the movie, when J.J. Geddes is screwed and he's got nowhere to turn and he's trying to set everybody else up, he goes to the house and knocks on the door, and Burt Young's wife answers the door. And Burt Young then helps J.J. Geddes escape and get away from those guys so he can continue on with his plan. It's the greatest use of use what you have. Somebody else would have said, oh, create a new character, write in a new character. How can we get his partners involved where he has to be exposition heavy to explain? Because of the use of this character, we stay in the dark about what's really happening. Because while I've been saying the whole time, we're getting in the head of J.J. Geddes, we're still in his head because at this point, he's still throwing it together. We just know everybody's going to meet in Chinatown. That's all we know. We don't need to know more than that because that's really all he knows. But he also knows that he can go to this guy. And when she opens the door, she got a black eye. So we know. And then I love the part where he says, hey, it's that guy I was telling you who did that. And she's like, yeah, I know. Because obviously, you know, he's the guy who told me you were cheating on me. But I just think it's so brilliant because we have forgotten this character exists, and yet he comes back in one of the most important moments of the movie to help J.J. Geddes, and J.J. Geddes is using his connections in any way he can to make things happen. And he's part of the plan. There's not a single wasted character or moment in this movie. And like if you're writing something, look at the way that that happens, because you could have easily just said, oh, he went to a different character, or he went and got somebody else to drive him, or he had a car in a shop. No, he gets somebody else involved who can now help Evelyn and her daughter escape, and who is indebted to him beyond money, right? Because we even hear say, "Oh, I'm sorry, I'll pay you back. I swear, this will cover that, and I'll give you money." It's just fantastic. I always love that so much because you forget that it's going to happen every time. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it caught me off guard when I was watching it. It's like, oh, this is that guy from the beginning of the movie. I guess I should have paid more attention. But I also love how that beginning scene also gives it almost gives that expectation where Polanski's playing with our expectations of it by using the black and white photos there. And like, it's the full frame shot of black and white. You're like, oh, okay, Polanski's going all the way with this because you have the like sepia tone credits, opening credits with like the jazz trumpet playing behind it. And then you get these black and white photos. And it's like, oh, maybe like he went black and white with this. And then it reveals the greater world around that. It kind of tells this idea that like Polanski is paying homage to these old movies, but still making his own movie at the same time.
Well, and I do want to talk about Jerry Goldsmith's score because Jerry Goldsmith's score in this movie is incredible. Like it's just, it's so great. It really captures an era that it's not actually a part of. That's what's so impressive about it. Like it is nailing that era, but it's not actually from that era. And it's, it still sounds like it could be in the 70s. Like it's just perfect. And this is the movie I always like makes me associate with classic Hollywood, even though it's from 1974. I feel like this really hits all the tropes of what made the classic Hollywood era, the classic Hollywood era. And that type of music is one of those things. Ended up not winning screen. The only thing that this won an Oscar for was best screenplay because it did come out the same year as The Second Godfather, which, you know, cleaned up a lot. But then Harry and Tonto won, Art Carney won for that, for best actor. But I just want to see what won for best score. Best score went to, where is it? The Godfather 2. So like you can't, I mean, like, what are you going to do? You can't argue that. But at the same time, Jerry Goldsmith's score like really elevates this movie. Really elevates it. Yeah. Was there anything else? Oh, so this was a question I just wanted to ask you, John, because I have what I call the Polanski Big Three. As you can see, they're in my top 100. I have three of his movies in my top 100. You don't have any Polanski in your top 100, right? Or did you have Chinatown? You didn't, right?
I have Rosemary's Baby.
You did have Rosemary's Baby. Okay, so you had Rosemary's Baby. Well, then that might defeat the purpose of my question, but I guess now that you've watched all three, do you still consider Rosemary's Baby as best one?
I think so.
Yeah.
I do think so. I think that's part of the part of me is the horror lover in me and like the way that film's made. I didn't really get into noir until we started this podcast. Mm-hmm. So maybe in time, Chinatown dethrones it. But I still prefer the horror genre more than the noir genre at the moment.
Yeah, I have three of his movies in my top 38 of all time with The Pianist, Chinatown, and Rosemary's Baby. And I have Chinatown as number one, and I think it'll stay there after rewatching them all pretty close together. I mean, within a half year, I'd still keep Chinatown as my number one. But because I just think I love noirs, and I think when a noir is made great, it's so much fun. And Chinatown is so much fun in such a dark way, and I just love it. So I just wanted to throw that out there. But Polanski, I mean, that's a horror Nazi war film and a film noir. Like, it's a shame what he is as a person, you know, because that really upended his career in a lot of things. But it's just, it's crazy. You got anything else you want to say about Chinatown?
Nope.
Cool. All right. Well, we're moving on. Next week, we'll be back. Number 13 in our top 100. We're talking about Fargo from 1996 and Dr. Strangelove or How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Bomb from 1964. My favorite Stanley Kubrick film. And I believe, is this the highest ranked Coen Brothers film that we have? Do you have another Coen?
No. Yes. Yes, it is.
It is. So, yes. And I had Fargo in my top 100 a little bit lower down. So it'll be fun that we're finally getting to talk about this. But yeah, Fargo and Dr. Strangelove. That'll be a fun podcast. Thank you all for listening. Hope you're all enjoying. Become patrons. Subscribe here. If you're a Survivor fan who is discovering this, thank you. If you're a fan of movies who also happens to like Survivor and don't know all about that fun stuff, we'll be live in like an hour and a half, me and Alexa, talking about Survivor stuff. So Thank you all for listening, though. 13 episodes left. That's it, John. Crazy to think that that's the case. We're going to have to do like a rendition of Diane Keaton singing Old Days as we go through this, much like Annie Hall has. So we'll do that at some point. Somebody can edit that, though, because I'm not going to. Anyway, thank you all for being fans, and we'll see you next week.